roundup of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch rejects claims that legislation he sponsored led to decreased DEA enforcement of black market opioids. Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams makes his run against Mia Love official. And religious leaders ask for more housing progress before the closure of the Road Home shelter. Those and other stories on the docket today. Joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Anderson. Welcome, Taylor.
Thanks, Roger.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joining us on the phone, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Welcome, Tommy, and good morning to you.
Hey, good morning.
And you can join us for this conversation as well. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. A variety of interesting stories today on the show, but let's start with some news from the latter half of the week. The announcement by Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams that he will indeed run against Mia Love in the 2018 election. Taylor Anderson, you covered the story. What did McAdams say about why he was doing this and why now?
He said for the last few years he's been elected twice to Salt Lake County Mayor, his current position. And he said that for the last 5 years or so, there's been a roadblock in the federal government, both with the administration and with Congress. And he says he's going there because he's a bipartisan workhorse who can get along with everybody. And, you know, he's going to go to Congress and change the gridlock and actually get stuff done for Utah.
It just sounds like a very familiar message for any candidate announcing.
Right.
McAdams was just a year ago reelected to Salt Lake County Mayor. What happens with the office that he's currently, you know, sitting in?
That's the convenient part for him. Everyone knew that he was pretty interested in some other form of higher office. For this one in particular, given that the race is next November, or the election is next November, he won't have to give up his position if he wins or if he loses. Excuse me, if he wins, he'll be in D.C. But he continues to be Salt Lake County Mayor even while he's campaigning. He doesn't have to give that seat up.
Okay, and I want to get to some questions about that. But how is Congresswoman Mia Love's team responding to the news that that McAdams has announced?
They say she's strong. She's doing well. She's been elected twice to that position. With millions of dollars of negative campaign ads spent against her, and she's still polling fairly well. So when McAdams says he's got a shot and that the polls are on his side, Mia Love's team says that she's doing just fine, she's holding steady, and that she'll be able to win fine.
I want to turn to Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke for a moment here. Robert, this race feels like it's kind of been sort of a long time coming.
Well, we've been kind of waiting for McAdams to kind of make a play for another seat. Always kind of knew there he was priming himself for a run at something. And this one kind of makes sense. I mean, Ben's point about how he represents most of the district already in Salt Lake County, because 85% of the voters in the 4th district are in Salt Lake County. You know, he's won already there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it makes a lot of sense in that regard. He's got some specific criticisms of Congresswoman Love, things that he feels like they should have been able to get done to help the county and help the district, and he says they haven't. So,
and some of those relate to, you know, Medicaid expansion or
Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion is actually a pretty big one. What were some of the others, Taylor? He talks about sort of transportation funding and some of the, you know, maybe getting some federal help for the homeless issue and things that the county has sort of been left holding the bag on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's going to set up to be a good race. I mean,
and an expensive one, probably, as it has been in the past.
I would imagine it's going to be very expensive. Mia has a lot of money in the bank already right now. I think she has somewhere in the neighborhood of about $600,000 or $700,000 in the bank right now, which is not enough to run a race, but it's $600,000 or $700,000 that Ben has to raise just to, you know, sort of play in this race for, and he's got, you know, a limited amount of time to do it.
And Taylor Anderson is he starting from ground zero, square one? He has to raise that amount. He has nothing so far in his coffers.
I think so. I'm not totally sure how the congressional race if he can use whatever funds that he has from his current PACs for county mayor.
Because Utah doesn't have campaign contribution limits and allows corporate donations, that you can't take that money and roll it into a federal race because there's a prohibition on corporate money, right. and there's a limit. So yeah, he's starting from zero. Not necessarily from zero, because people know who he is. They voted for him before. But yeah, in terms of mounting the federal race, he's going to have to start raising money very soon.
Okay. And Taylor, McAdams says that he expects things to get negative in this campaign, but not because he himself or necessarily even his opponent are going to take them in that direction.
Yeah, he said he wants to keep it positive. He wants to tell people who he is. He needs to introduce himself to about 15% of the district, because his position as county mayor, he represents about 85% of District 4. He lives in, is it District...
He lives in District 2, Congressman Stewart's district.
But about a block away from this district, so he actually represents a lot of this, and about 15%, which is like Juab County, San Pete County, and the western part of Utah County.
Right.
And he's going to introduce himself in a positive light. But you know, these campaigns, this is shaping up to be probably the most competitive race, a congressional race for Utah. There's not currently two candidates, I don't think, two well-known candidates for Senate yet. But you know, outside money will find its way to Utah for sure.
Yeah, to be determined. Mia Love has kind of the incumbent's advantage, and this is Utah, so-called red state, but. Robert Gerke, you know, the advantages, you've mentioned some of them already that McAdams might have, or the strengths that he have, mm-hmm. include the fact that he already represents 85%. What else has he got conceivably going for him?
Well, he's got good name recognition, good name ID. It's going to be interesting. One of the things that's going to be kind of interesting to watch is how sort of the Republican partisans react to this, because you know, in the past, the Republican Party and Republican officials have come out hard against, you know, Doug Owens when he ran against Congresswoman Love. But McAdams has good relationships with a lot of the Republican establishment. You know, he and Speaker Hughes and Spencer Cox are you know, get along pretty well. And you know, so that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch, I think.
How will, sorry, go ahead.
No, you're fine.
I'm just wondering how, you know, McAdams has been a big part of the new effort on homelessness in Salt Lake mm-hmm. County. Will his running for this seat affect how he addresses that effort? And for that matter, if he wins, what effect will that have?
Well, I mean, it could play into that, how he gets along with guys like Spencer Cox and Greg Hughes, right? I mean, those are the two sort of leading figures on the homelessness issue right now. And, you know, are they going to want to help Ben McAdams do something that is going to help his campaign? You know, it could have some impacts there. One of the things I think is going to be interesting is how, if you remember a little while ago, the state was trying to lure Facebook into West Jordan mm-hmm. for that server warehouse that they were trying to build. But McAdams came out strongly against that, and there could be some residual hard feelings in West Jordan and Riverton, and that's a growing part of that district, because it's the fastest growing part of that district.
Potentially some other hard feelings from the location decision on where to put a shelter. Is that a homeless resource center?
It'll be a liability for him, I think. I don't think that it's going to necessarily harm him too much, but it could be a liability.
Taylor?
He thought that a reporter the day that he announced that he was going to put it in South Salt Lake, which is in the 4th District, asked him if he thought he was going to suffer politically because of that decision, and he just had a one-word answer. He said yes. But our story today, which was a poll story, it shows that he's still polling pretty well across the state, but also specific to this district. He's doing pretty fine. South Salt Lake doesn't have too many people, and that's kind of simmered a little bit. It could hurt him, but he had to, state law kind of handcuffed him. He had to pick a site, so.
Okay. And Taylor, the poll that ran today had what were the numbers again? 48-42.
48-42.
So he's within striking distance. I mean, that's, you know, when you look at the Doug Owens race, he lost by considerably more than that in the second run against him. So he's doing well. You know, but it's going to, and Mia Love isn't above 50, which is sort of an important threshold when you're looking at political campaigns. You kind of want to, if you're an incumbent in particular, you want to be up above 50. So.
Okay. Well, we will see. If Mr. McAdams does go to Washington, there to cover his arrival will be Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington bureau chief.
Nice transition.
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. You're welcome. Actually, I'm sure you'll be paying close attention to this race, but I want to actually turn to some stuff that you've been paying close attention to right now but let's take a quick break first, and we will come back to that. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, Environment Reporter Emma Penrod, Government Reporter Taylor Anderson, and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning local news wrap-up, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. And to Thomas Burr now. Tommy, let's turn to a story out of Washington that you are paying close attention to. That involves Senator Orrin Hatch. The senator sponsored a bill last year that President Obama ended up signing into law. It's a bill that in the past couple of days has been through kind of the reporting ringer. The subject of that reporting is America's opioid epidemic. And Tommy, let's get up to speed. What was this bill and why is it now under scrutiny?
Kind of flew under the radar for the most part. I don't think many people paid attention to it. But yes, it was sponsored by Orrin Hatch and Tom Marino, who was for a little while President Trump's nominee to be the national drug czar. And the bill passed unanimously out of the House and Senate, signed by Obama. And the Washington Post in 60 Minutes did an investigation showing that what this bill actually did was hamper and kind of curtail the DEA's ability to stop large drug shipments, even when there was questionable circumstances around it. So even though they knew that there were, you know, tons of opioids being sent to Ohio or West Virginia to these pharmacies, they weren't able to stop it. And that's the concern. Hatch has pushed back on this a lot, and he says, look, you know, no one objected to this, including the DEA, the White House. Again, it passed by what's called unanimous consent, which means that it was non-controversial when it passed through Congress. But it has been blamed in some part for the spread of opioids in some parts of America where, right. I think, you know, 200,000 people have already died.
Well, yeah, across America, 200,000 people have died. And I've seen some of the reporting on this that there were counties where something like, you know, 25,000 people lived, but that might be receiving 10 million doses of oxycodone or hydrocodone in just a few years period. The point of the reporting is that by weakening the DEA oversight of drug companies with this bill, Congress was in a way complicit in America's opioid epidemic. So, I mean, this flew under the radar. What I'm wondering is whether or not Congress knew what they were passing.
Well, sometimes Congress doesn't know what they're passing. We can just be blunt about that. And there's some criticism about Orrin Hatch, too, because, you know, some critics would say he's Senator Orrin Hatch, our pharma. He's definitely got a lot of money from the pharmaceutical industry, the drug industry, during his career. And he did do this. But his point is he met with the DEA, he negotiated the bill, they didn't object to the language. In fact, they wrote part of the language that was in the bill. And now this is criticism, he says, that from, you know, when essentially the deep state. These are Obama people complaining about something now to make it Trump's fault.
Hatch, I mean, he kind of puts the onus on other actors, as you said, like the DEA, President Obama, for one, who signed this bill into law. I guess, you know, I'm wondering, you said in your reporting that the president would be taking some sort of action on America's opioid crisis, declaring a kind of emergency. Is that correct?
Yes, we understand. He said he's going to do this next week. You know, sometimes he says things that don't actually happen, but from what we understand, he's going to declare it a national emergency next week, which should hopefully free up some more resources to combat this crisis. I mean, Utah, I think at one point was named the seventh worst by per capita in the nation in the opioid crisis, and I think there's, you know, several, you know, dozen deaths that happen in the state every month. It's pretty dire.
Is there any chance that you know, the language of this bill that hampers the DEA from, you know, to look at these opioid sales, that language will get fixed, Tommy? Is that something that any lawmaker in Washington is trying to address?
Yeah, I think there's a couple bills already been introduced since the Washington Post and 60 Minutes investigation, because, again, I don't think people realized that this was an issue. So, yes, I think people are going to look at it. We'll see where Orrin Hatch comes down on that. He believes that right now the DEA still has the tools they need to combat this, and that his law did not actually impact their ability to combat the crisis.
To Robert Gerke from the Opinion Desk on this. Robert, how do you view this, both the reporting and then also the Senator Orrin Hatch's response to it?
Well, I mean, I think I don't think anybody disagrees on the sort of the fundamentals of how this bill became a law, right? It doesn't happen exactly like we learned in Schoolhouse Rock, but this thing, as Tommy mentioned, nobody voted against it. There wasn't anybody who spoke against this provision of the bill. And it was authored by the DEA, although they expressed some reluctance about the language at the time. But this, I don't think anybody disagrees either that this makes it considerably harder for DEA to stop these shipments of these suspicious shipments of medications. And in fact, the chief administrative law judge for the DEA wrote a 115-page law review article that the fundamental underlying premise of is that this bill does make it harder for DEA to freeze these shipments. And that makes it harder to root out these pill mills. And so if Orrin Hatch wants people to believe he's acting in good faith, what he should do is not complain about, well, nobody else voted against it, or, you know, what he should do is introduce legislation like right now, repealing this provision of the bill and letting DEA go back to, you know, freezing these shipments. It's something that they rarely were doing anyway, but it makes it in, you know, as this administrative law judge, almost impossible for them to get one of these, they're called immediate suspension orders, to stop these suspicious packages. And so, you know, he can complain about the reporting, he can complain about the process, or he can complain that, you know, people are being unfair to him. But if people want to, like, actually believe that he's, you know, got good intentions in this, then he needs to step up and fix it, and not, you know, point the finger at other people, like, oh, I didn't do it. Well,
the amount of money involved, both, you know, the profit to be had by the specifically the profit to be had by pharmaceutical companies must be massive.
Massive, and there are really only four shipping companies that do this, that like are distributing these. You know, these are companies that take it from the pill producers and ship them to the pharmacies, to the doctors. And so, you know, they have a stranglehold on, you know, the 60 Minutes piece in particular was pretty compelling in it quoted this former DEA agent Joe Renacisi, and you know his commentary was that he's never seen anything like this in Washington in his years. And you know, Hatch's people call him disgruntled ex-DEA people, but you know, this Joe Renacisi was a respected person who, you know, testified repeatedly before Congress. And then you've got these, you know, guys like Tom Marino who, you know, have taken an insane amount of money from the pharmaceutical industry, sort of doing the bidding of Big Pharma.
Tommy, you know, talking about Marino, he had, as you mentioned, been, appointed, he'd been a Trump appointee, drug czar. This reporting essentially thwarted that appointment. Is there somebody else who's waiting in the wings to fill that post?
I mean, we'll see. But I think the interesting part of this is after all the White House pushed back and Orrin Hatch pushes back and says there was nothing here, there's nothing, this problem, Tom Marino, who was going to be the drug czar, withdrew to be the drug czar. So if there was nothing there in the reporting, then why did he say he didn't want to take on the role?
You know, we talked about the potential for a declaration of emergency by the president. I actually want to turn to a story that you reported on about the president. This is a terrible transition, but it has to do with his approval rating here in Utah, Tommy. And it turns out that his approval rating has been ticking up a bit here in the state.
Yeah, so this was a Salt Lake Tribune Hinckley Institute poll that showed that President Trump's now at 52% approval rating in Utah. Which is higher than last month, where Utah Policy Poll had him at about 46% approval rating. So right now, 52% of Utahns approve of President Trump, 46% disapprove. Digging down, and so it is a little slight uptick, but these things have flown. It kind of depends. He's kind of hovered around 50% almost all year since his election. He got about 45% of the vote in Utah last November.
Right.
So he's kind of been between 46, 52, back and forth a little bit. It all kind of ebbs and flows a little bit. One of the most interesting things I think in the poll was when you look at the Democrat crosstab and you say, okay, where did Democrats come across with President Trump? 89% strongly disapprove. 89%. It's just very clear Democrats in Utah have no faith in the president.
But if I could jump in real quick, one of the things that struck me about the poll is looking at the same crosstab and seeing the Republican number, because across the country we've seen a sort of a softening even in Trump's base. If they haven't completely left, they've gone from strongly approved to somewhat approved. That doesn't seem to be the case in Utah, and I think we've got almost 40% of those Republicans who strongly approve of the job he's doing, which has been pretty consistent since he took office.
It's about 33% strongly approved, 39% somewhat approved.
I had those numbers right now, but
I mean, it's still a pretty huge base for the president in Utah. I mean, it's a Republican stronghold, of course, but Utahns weren't so ecstatic about Trump to begin with. So for him to hold on to those numbers, even after all the issues with his White House, is pretty impressive.
I think the
potential impact of that strongly approved number among Republicans in particular is that you may not see sort of the Trump effect in elections that Democrats are hoping to see. They're hoping that, you know, Republicans are dispirited and stay home, and they can maybe it plays into this Ben McAdams Mia Love race that we talked about. But when you have that strong of approval among Republicans, they're probably gonna stick with their guy, and they're gonna come out and vote like they traditionally do.
Hmm. And that's, I mean, is that the numbers, of course, don't show why there's an uptick or why there's as strong of support. And is it just that, Robert, that he's the Republican in the top Republican in a largely Republican state? He's the top Republican in the country.
And you kind of got to think so, and maybe it's a little bit of bunker mentality. Maybe they're tired of Democrats and the media beating up on their guy, and they're gonna circle the wagons a little bit. Because to be honest, there's really not much else that he's done that plays into what Utahns want to see done. You know, I mean, he hasn't been able to repeal health care, which I think would probably be a boost for him, and Utahns don't necessarily like his immigration positions. So it's kind of hard to point to anything else that would, make Utahns feel like he's doing a good job other than, the party label.
If this is way too speculative, but if he was to run for re-election, would he take the state again? I guess is the question that I wonder. But right now, it looks like he would.
Yeah, you would have to think so, just because we haven't seen any Democrat contending in this, for this state in a long time. And, I mean, obviously, it kind of depends on who the candidates are.
And he didn't win the primary here.
He didn't win the primary. He did really poorly in the primary here. I think Ted Cruz got about 70%. But I don't think you're going to see, you might see Republicans run against him, and that might be, that might make things interesting. But in the general election, that party identification is such a strong prevailing factor in every election we've had. And so I don't see any reason to think that he wouldn't win the state if he was on the ballot again in 2020.
Okay. I have a fair amount of news to get through, so we're going to leave the poll there behind for now and turn to something a bit different. And environment reporter Emma Penrod, first off, welcome. Thanks for being here
on
the show this morning. You have been, you are looking at a topic that is kind of been in the news for a number of years now in your reporting, and it's the Lake Powell Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
You reported that there's a group here in Utah questioning some of the data that's been provided by the state of Utah and by certain counties related to water usage here. And what's the story behind this, Emma?
Yeah, so this group is the Utah Rivers Council. They're dedicated to maintaining the health of Utah's waterways, and in particularly tend to oppose projects like the Lake Powell Pipeline and the Bear River Development Act, because they don't want to see more rivers have more water taken out of them. They want the water to stay in the rivers. And over the last couple of months, they have observed proponents of the Lake Powell Pipeline cite different numbers with regard to how much water people in Washington County are using. The Lake Powell Pipeline, it would take water from Lake Powell and it would ship it over to Washington County, St. George area. So how much water they're using is a critical figure because it determines, whether or not this community needs more water.
Mm.
And what they found was that depending on who the audience was, different numbers, you know, seemed to be being quoted to, you know, lawmakers versus federal regulators, and so on.
Is the concern coming from Utah Rivers Council that numbers are being inflated to justify the construction of the pipeline?
Their concern is that the numbers may be being used to mislead people into believing that there is a more critical need for this pipeline than the Rivers Council believes there is.
What do state regulators say to that?
I haven't got a response from them other than that they said they didn't believe that misunderstanding, this was the Division of Water Resources, said that any misunderstanding as a result of the different numbers being floated was unintentional, in their opinion.
This isn't the first time that this has been pointed out, the idea that that the numbers don't match up when it comes to how much water is being used in Washington County, for example. Mm-hmm. It's Utah Rivers Council who has pointed that out before. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes. They had previously brought a case to the State Records Committee arguing for the release of the state's underlying water database of information related to water use after finding that there were numbers that the state was reporting different use numbers for the Washington County area than they had seen quoted in materials they obtained elsewhere.
What's the cost of this pipeline? Who would pay for it? Two-part question. I ask. I know it's kind of a complicated. The second part of that is somewhat complicated by the plan to pay for this pipeline.
Well, I think those questions are the questions everyone wants answers to. The numbers being floated most recently are in the range of $1.1 to $1.8 billion to construct the pipeline. So more than $30 million has already been spent on the planning process. So this isn't something that, you know, we haven't started spending money on because the state has started spending money on it already and costs will likely continue to accrue as we continue to move through the environmental permitting process.
And what's going on with that? This is something where the federal government has to grant a permit to the state for the construction, construction of this pipeline? Mm-hmm.
Well, right now, the state's in the process of trying to get a license from FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, because there are plans to include some hydropower generating stations in this particular project. So they need a permit to run hydropower generation.
You mentioned that, you know, some money has already been spent on this. Has the pipeline itself ever been kind of approved in a legislative sense? I mean, does it have the official go-ahead, or is it still just a proposal?
Yes, it was. There is a state law that was passed in 2006 that authorized the construction of the pipeline.
Okay. You know, we hear a lot about the projected population growth of the state and therefore a need for increased water resources, but we don't hear a lot about other ways that water savings might happen in the coming years. Part of that, according to conservation groups, has to do with where growth is happening in the state, in urban areas. Cities, it turns out, use less water than agriculture does.
Yes.
And so there's some expected savings in water that way?
Yeah. Generally speaking, for the amount of land, if you have, 10 acres of farmland, you're going to have to put more water to irrigate those crops on that farmland than you would if you had 10 acres of houses because, you know, a good portion of that land of, if you put houses on it, is going to be covered up by surfaces like concrete that you aren't going to water. So as we, urbanize throughout Utah, there will most likely be agricultural lands that will be taken out of production, and therefore that water won't be used as much, which will potentially free up more water for, municipalities. However, this is a really controversial issue in Utah, where many residents have expressed strong opinions that agricultural water should remain in the agricultural sector and that municipal supplies should not be buying up water that is being used by farmers.
What is that? What is the bulk of that agricultural product? I mean, what are we growing here?
The number one product in Utah is alfalfa.
Alfalfa. Okay. And that, I mean, what that's for feed for animals? Is
yes,
that correct?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. What's the water situation of Lake Powell? This is where the water would come from. How is Lake Powell doing? If you're able to answer that, Emma.
So Lake Powell's doing better this last year thanks to the snowpack that we had over the winter. It's recovered somewhat, but Lake Mead and Lake Powell have both been quite low over the last couple of years as a result of an extended drought, which has, you know, caused many people who rely on these systems for water to, you know, start talking about needing to develop drought contingency plans and finding a way to address, you know, what do we do if the water supply coming from these reservoirs is not what we thought it was going to be.
Okay. Robert Gerke, just from the opinion desk, and there's a sort of hint at not inflated but differing numbers that may be used to justify a pretty expensive project.
I would go so far as to call them inflated. I mean, I think the really frustrating thing that, about this whole Lake Powell project that people have been adamantly pushing for years is we don't have a good idea of the water current water use. We don't have a good idea of the actual water demands going into the future, and we have no idea at all about how they're going to pay for it. The financing is very much in doubt. And in fact, even the governor last year, when he rolled out his budget, made a specific point of saying, we don't know, we don't have this data, we don't have this information. And what you need reliable data before you go out and spend $1.5 billion of taxpayer money on this. And so, these water buffaloes, these water warriors are dead set on getting this done, and they're going to bend the information and bend the data and manipulate the data and hide the ball until they get their way. And there's going to be a lot of money made by somebody down there on this too. And so, we need to make sure we have reliable information. And I think the Rivers Council is just asking for, let's be transparent. Let's, you know, show us your information. Let's get, you know, let's make sure we're doing this in a positive way.
Emma, who stands to benefit, following the money financially from the construction of this pipeline? Obviously, construction companies would be one part of it. Are there water users associations that make money out of a big deal like this?
Most likely, the revenue would end up at the water conservancy districts that would be selling the water to municipalities, which would then sell it to residents. It's largely targeted as it's needed, they say, because they need to continue the growth in the area. And it's worth noting that these water districts do get the majority of their income from property taxes. And so if growth continues and property values continue to increase, that will increase their revenue as well.
Are they the same ones who are doing the reporting on the data that Utah Rivers Council is calling to question?
Yes.
Okay. You know what, guys? I want to get to some more stories in just a moment, but thanks for your reporting on this, Emma. Oh, go ahead.
It may be worth noting just really quick. You talked about the questions about the financing. The state released some more information about the financing of the pipeline last night, and there will be additional coverage of that on our website this morning.
SLTrip.com. Yeah, like I said, more stories coming up just ahead on Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. But right now, we need to head to another quick break. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Anderson, Emma Penrod, Thomas Burr, and columnist Robert Gerke. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And I want to circle back around to government reporter Taylor Anderson. Taylor, here in Salt Lake City, the Road Home Shelter, the major homeless shelter in town, is slated to close in 2019, but some local faith leaders are concerned about that. Why are they concerned?
They want to make sure that a state law that was passed in the most recent legislative session it has an end date to the Road Home, which is 1,100 beds. The new shelters that we're opening up will leave a gap of about 400, and that's going to be made up by improved homeless services. That it's going to get people who in need to where they need to go. So it's a more effective way of helping people get into homes, and also by new housing stock that's supposed to come online between now and summer of 2019. They were saying that's a pretty short timeline to build hundreds of units that we need. So if that hasn't happened by summer of 2019, let's postpone that date of closing the Road Home downtown, because they believe that we're going to need those housing units.
So these groups are kind of concerned with the kind of rush to close the shelter, that we won't have those housing units online in time. What do city and county officials say about that? And I guess we should throw the state into that mix, since, you know, there's something of a triumvirate involved in this issue. What's the response there?
Well, so they delivered. It was 36 religious leaders, and they wrote a letter. It was pretty well timed because that week, this past week, the city council was set to talk about this, their long-term and short-term housing plans. They've got a few projects that they're talking about possibly launching and getting us going on, you know, even if you can believe it, ramping up the production of apartments, of housing units across the city. So they delivered that to Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski on, was it Monday afternoon, and she said, look, you know, there's that bill that it's out of my hands. It was passed by the legislature. It says that the road home will close on June 30th of 2019. I can't do anything about that. But by the way, we're going to have some hearings between now and the end of this year with the city council. If you go, you know, point your attention to them and say, let's get going with these projects, that this is from the mayor speaking, we're going to get some housing units on the ground. So it was kind of well-timed on everybody's part to point to the city council, to point to the county, just everybody just focus on housing and getting units built right now.
Okay. I want to just for a moment circle back to the bill that requires the closure of the road home shelter. Where did that stipulation in that bill come from? Anybody?
Well, I mean, it's so there's been this back and forth for a while about, you know, will the road home close for certain? Will it not close for certain? And it... From my opinion, I would think what happened is there was enough uncertainty about it that it concerned these downtown business owners who have been driving this issue for a long time. They want to see it closed. They want certainty that it's going to be closed so they don't have to worry about it affecting their property values. And that's, you know, so I think they got it put in there to kind of make sure that that it's going to close. Because there had been these questions about, well, what if we leave it open, or what if we use it for, you know, overflow or surge, you know, because right now the fundamental issue is we have an affordable housing crisis in this city, and that's exacerbating this problem of homelessness. Because even if even if Operation Rio Grande is successful and you get people out of the downtown area, they said at their update this week they had three families get into transitional housing. That's great, but you've got three families out of about 1,600 people who've been arrested, and so you've got to really amplify. You've got to speed up this process of getting this affordable housing in place. And the religious leaders make a valid point that while it's aspirational to think that we're going to have affordable housing to move these people into, you maybe don't put a date certain termination date on the road home until you have something, until you're confident you're going to have something in place.
The faith groups involved are the Episcopal Diocese of Utah, First Baptist Church of Salt Lake City, Trinity Presbyterian Church of Ogden, Congregation Kol Ami, a couple of faiths not represented there, probably most notably the big player, the Mormon Church. Taylor Anderson, why not?
Well, just the group that spearheaded the letter, which is Crossroads Urban Center. They work on homeless issues and low income issues, you know, just generally. And they just said it would take too long to get church approval from their experience in the past. So I wouldn't look too much into it. But they just said we want to get this letter out there before these meetings. We're not going to wait for approval from the LDS Church.
What is happening on the affordable housing front? I mean, how much funding is being put into it? How many units are, you know, conceivably being built? This is something that you reported the city is kind of rushing to get through.
I mean, if you look around the city and around the county, there are big apartment buildings that are going up. But if you look into the numbers, a lot of those units are $1,500 units a piece, and you know, a lot of people, that's not affordable. When we're talking about affordable housing, you have to look at the, you know, the threshold of how much of your income, of a person's income, are they going to spend on rent? And, you know, about 30% is kind of the goal. So if you, you know, 30% of $1,400 unit is somebody has to be making a decent living.
$80,000 a year.
Yeah.
That's not, you know,
affordable.
That's not affordable.
The city, they're looking at, you know, they've got projects. And again, going back to this housing plan, they want to be able to say, you know, when a developer comes and says, if we get, you know, X, Y, and Z funding from the city or help from the county or the state or wherever, we want to greenlight this project. And the city has to be able to say, that's in our plan. We're going to go ahead with it. There are a number of projects across the city that would... You know, they've got the city council set aside about $21.6 million for this purpose. When they're ready to greenlight these projects, they can give some money to, you know, make a project pencil out for that would include, you know, a portion of housing units that would be affordable to somebody making 40% of the median income, which is about minimum wage around that.
Right around minimum wage for an individual doing that.
It's probably also worth noting, too, that in addition to the shortage of the housing stock and affordable housing stock in the city, we're also starting to see a diminishment or a reduction in the federal payments to subsidize the housing. And it's anticipated that that's going to continue to shrink and those funds won't be there. And so, it just makes the crisis that much worse when you start seeing that money going away.
Robert, is the closure, the forced closure date again of the Road Home Shelter, is that rushed, or is that just part of the aspirational thing that you were talking about, that it, you know, they needed to have? It's a tough question.
It is, but sometimes it's good to have a deadline, as those of us who work in newspapers know. Sometimes we wouldn't get our story done ever if we don't have deadlines. So maybe that's what they're doing here, is setting a deadline to say, okay, we have to see some action, we have to see some movement. You know, there's always the option of that they can come back if they don't see that housing stock coming online and then change the date, postpone it a year. They do that fairly frequently in legislative matters. But to give Road Home a death sentence without having your safety net there, or without having the transitional housing in place, I think is probably a little premature. I think it's good. It's something we need to keep an eye on over the next 18 months before the Road Home closes, and then see where we are, I think, a year from now, and kind of make a judgment then.
And Taylor, is the funding in place to actually, you know, from the city, their portion of funding to build these units, is that now sort of ready to be spent?
Which units is that?
Oh, sorry, for affordable housing in general, I guess.
They have that pool of $21 million. I wouldn't say anybody would say they have enough money for the amount of deed that's out there. So,
right.
No.
And then just on the same topic or a related topic, I guess, what about the progress of the homeless resource centers and their construction? Is that coming along?
It's in the design process. The architects are working on making sure that they're meeting the... You know, there's a bunch of different needs, even just in architectural design, that they think that consultants have said will help a person transition from homelessness into a house, and so that's the process that we're in right now, is design.
Okay. I want to just get to one story more before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, and it's kind of a tough one. It's one that you reported on just yesterday, Taylor, the death of Salt Lake County recorder Gary Ott after a struggle with Alzheimer's disease. How did we find out about it? And this came just months after his leaving office, really.
Right. Yeah. So to the public, I mean, if to the public, this was a very, very quick decline.
Right.
Because these details were not public until last week. We didn't know what was wrong with Gary Ott specifically. People knew from news reports over the last 18 months that something was going on.
Right.
But we were not told the full story until a court case was kept open, and these witnesses who knew Gary very well over the last 10 years or more were on the stand and saying, I knew this 4 years ago. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2013, and we didn't find that out until 1 week ago yesterday. So it appeared to be a quick decline, but he was actually suffering from this illness for a number of years, and it looks like we were told in court last week that he had stage 4 Alzheimer's. It's a terminal illness, and he was progressing. So it looks like that's what happened. He died yesterday at 4 a.m. at the age of 66.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk about who knew what when, and you point out these witnesses pointing out that he had been diagnosed in 2013. Was there anybody keeping tabs on that as that decline occurred in office?
His former fiance, she said they call themselves life partners. They exchanged rings. Carmen Sinone, she also worked for him in the office. She was his exempt secretary. They lived together in North Ogden on her farm. She was attending these doctor's appointments. She had noted that she noticed a decline years ago. And, you know, the first doctor that they went to, or one of the first, He said, it looks like you have a form of dementia. I'm going to refer you to a neurologist. The neurologist said, yeah, it looks like dementia, most likely Alzheimer's. And she was attending these appointments where these diagnoses were being made. And, you know, up until this year, up until a couple months ago, she was telling the public that there was nothing wrong with Gary. He was a little quirky, but he was still there signing off, running the office. And now we know that that wasn't actually, doesn't look like that was actually the case.
I know there were some tributes that came out from people who expressed sympathy and also gratitude for his years of public service. The governor, among others, when he learned about this during his monthly news conference.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a really, you know, sympathetic story, because even from Mayor Jackie Biskupski also tweeted out Ben McAdams, who had called on Gary to resign, knowing that something, this might be the case, he had called for him to resign in June just to kind of get things going. Anyways, he was being described as a dedicated service. He was in the office for over a decade, a dedicated servant, excuse me, and he was a loyal Republican. He was involved, and so Republicans are reaching out and saying, you know, that we'll miss you, Gary, and thanks for the service. The governor, people just saying thank you.
Finally, you talked about you know, some of the things going on inside of the Salt Lake County Recorder's Office that people were worried about, maybe Gary Ott being taken advantage of. There's conceivably an investigation that's going to happen into that. Is that correct?
Right. The Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office has said that they've been investigating. It started in the Attorney General's office. Now Sim Gill, has his office has taken over, but they won't confirm who's the subject of the investigation, what it entails. There haven't been a lot of details released, so we'll have to wait and see if that goes anywhere.
Robert Gricke, is there any lesson to be learned here? Laws to be changed?
Well, I mean, they are addressing the issue of removing somebody from office. And, you know, it's a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy that, you know, we probably all know somebody who's gone through it, experienced the decline of somebody with dementia. I think it's, again, I wrote my column this week, I think Carmen Sinone and Julie Dole, their actions were just despicable and, you know, potentially criminal. I hope Sim Gill, wraps up his investigation so we can actually see what he's been able to find. But, you know, they took advantage of him. It seems apparent on its face that they took advantage of him and that they lied to the public and they lied to the taxpayers about his ability to carry out his duties. And you know, it's really sad. I mean, it's sad, too, that that Gary's health and it became a public spectacle. And you know, when you experience something like this, you need to be cared for and taken care of and protected. And they seem to not have any interest in doing any of that, and just kind of, you know, again, turned it into a circus. And it's really unfortunate.
We'll have to leave it there because we are up against the end of the show. And it's time now for our underplayed stories of the week. And maybe we will start off with Thomas Burr, who's in Washington, has been waiting on the line patiently. Tommy, what's your pick for underplayed story?
So this is actually, it's on page 8 of the Tribune today, but very fascinating. I did not know about this, but the National Rifle Association offers insurance if you shoot somebody. So for $13.95 a month, you can get up to $250,000 in civil protection and $50,000 in criminal defense. For a criminal offense if you shoot somebody.
It's very reasonable.
Such a fascinating thing. It's that some people are referring to it as murder insurance. Like, you can buy this and then you shoot somebody and then you're covered.
Wow. I had no idea. Interesting pick. Thanks for that, Tommy. Let's go to Emma Penrod, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, so I'm a nerd, so I was very excited to see that scientists announced this week that they had observed the collision of two neutron stars. This is a phenomenon that has not been observed before, and so it was pretty exciting. And some interesting discoveries that came out of it. They learned that light and gravity or gravitational waves travel at the same speed. Which was something that was theorized, but that hadn't, you know, been proven.
Wow.
And the other thing they discovered was that upon this collision, several heavy elements, including gold, were actually created by this collision. So that's pretty cool.
All the gold in the universe from this single collision. Really interesting. And Taylor Anderson, your pick for underplacement.
Well, now I don't have one. Brian Maffley, one of our environmental reporters, our other environmental reporter, wrote about the reintroduction of mountain goats to the LaSalle Mountains, which sounds nice, but it turns out they haven't been there in several millennia since the last ice age. So they're actually, environmentalists are saying that they're causing more harm than good because they actually haven't been there in a long time. So they're kind of an invasive species right now.
Hmm. Okay. Mountain goats being reintroduced. I'm going to go with an Olympic Exploratory Committee being formed to try and bid on either the 2026 or 2030 Olympics for Salt Lake City. Some improvements needed, a bunch of spending that would have to happen as well for facilities, if I'm not mistaken. Check it out at sltrip.com. I can't find the link right now. But that does it for this. Robert Gerke. I've gotten you, Robert. Your pick for underplayed story.
Well, just quickly. I mean, mine is if you've been following the Bruvies case, where the Bruvies prevailed, they beat the state on this. The state tried to shut them down for showing Deadpool. While serving alcohol, Bruvies won that lawsuit. Said it, it's not obscenity. You can serve alcohol there. The state's going to have to change the law. Well, Rocky Anderson, the former mayor who represented Bruvies in this case, has filed his motion for attorney's fees, and it looks like it could end up costing taxpayers $500,000. His attorney's fees for this case were $530,000, which will buy you a lot of beer and nachos at Bruvies, I guess.
All right. Thanks, Robert Gerke, for that pick. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. I want to thank, Emma Penrod, Taylor Anderson, Robert Gerke, and Tommy Burr, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, for being here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks very much to Ross Chambliss here at KCPW, who managed the broadcast today, up at Utah Public Radio, Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks as well to you. And thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. Join us again next week here on Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.